You know, a question we always ask ourselves, who are we? Where did we come from? What does this all mean? Well, something on this planet happened 200,000 years ago. What was it? Well, in a moment, our guest, Michael Tellinger, will tell us. Slave species of God, an incredible story. Stand by for this one on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Tellinger describes himself as a closet scientist and serial entrepreneur with a passion for the cosmos and pushing the boundaries of knowledge. He is a writer and performer by heart, scientist by calling. Michael graduated from Wits University in 1983 with a degree in pharmacy, and he worked for Canon Films in Los Angeles as a sound designer and an editor. He has written and recorded a multitude of recordings. His latest contribution to the arts is Side by Side with Angels for the Tsunami Disaster Fund, which features leading artists. As a writer in advertising, he also received a Clio Award in New York and had his own weekly show on Cape Cod Television. I should say Cape Talk Radio. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. Hi, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me on your show, George.
Likewise. And now, if I understand correctly, you are where now? In South Africa as we speak?
That's right. I'm in Johannesburg. It's actually a lovely, quiet day because it's actually a public holiday. We're having our local elections voting for new local government to hopefully improve services to the people. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, this is amazing how technology has allowed us to be able to do this as we broadcast worldwide tonight, Michael. So it's good to have you with us. And it's also equally good and exciting to talk with you about your thoughts and your theories on a subject that is dear not only to me, but to so many millions of people who are listening to this program tonight. You've got to tell me, though, here's a guy like you who's been very good in the arts. How did you get involved in this kind of investigation?
You know, it's been about 25 years of absolute passion for the subject, as you said yourself. I think once you stumble upon it, it doesn't let you go. And I remember distinctly the day that I was about 18 years old and somebody dropped Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods in my lap. And it changed my life, you know, and from that moment onwards, I carried on investigating and reading everything I could lay my hands on about the potential origins of humankind, which is not exactly the way that our historians have been telling us in schools and the sort of mainstream history books, but the alternative theories that are for some reason kept out of the mainstream of public knowledge.
There is a fellow here in the United States, he's in his 80s now, by the name of Zachariah Sitchin. I don't know if you're aware of Zachariah or not, but he has done a lot of work, as you have, into primarily the Sumerian texts. That's been his expertise as well. And you've looked at this too. Let's go back, though, for a little bit. You come up with a date of about 200,000 years ago that some event occurred on this planet. Tell me about that time period and how you came up with that year.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to say, obviously, I know about Zachariah Sitchin. He's been a great source of inspiration to me, as I'm sure he has been to many other writers.
Sure.
And I value him immensely and to his contribution to this sort of area of science. The year 200,000 is not only a year that Zachariah Sitchin also talks about from his own translations of Sumerian tablets and many other translators of Sumerian tablets. But it also seems to coincide with what we call mitochondrial Eve and chromosomal Adam, you know, the first humans that walked the earth. And I just happened to sit about 20 minutes from the cradle of humankind, which is about 20 minutes north of Johannesburg. And this is where it apparently all started. And what is fascinating is that this year, this figure of 200,000 years seems to repeat itself over and over again as you start digging and scratching and looking for scientific and historic evidence of our human origins. 200,000 years keep cropping up, either from translations of Sumerian tablets or scientific and genetic evidence that this is a time when man first walked on the earth.
And something very strange happened. It is amazing that mainstream science hasn't taken the time to do what so many experts in this kind of investigation, and I would say anthropology, have done, that your work, Zachariah Sitchin's work, there aren't a lot of people who've studied this.
Yeah, and it's bizarre. You know, I did some interviews with during the research for this book. I did some interviews at Wits University with the sort of heads of the genetic departments and, you know, plant genetics and human genetics and just to get their view on various things and where gene therapy and genetic engineering and our knowledge of genetics is. And what I found is that no two people actually agree on the same things. And this fascinated me. You know, I would have thought that geneticists would at least agree on certain things. So what I discovered is that nothing is written in stone. You know, don't take anything at face value because there's so much more evidence out there and information than what we've been given about our origins. You know, and it starts with the argument of creationists against evolutionists. And, you know, that's an age-old argument. And it's a fantastic argument because in my book and in the research that I've stumbled upon, it now suddenly seems that you know, creationists and evolutionists can actually very cozily coexist in the same pond.
Michael, how would you categorize the theories in your book, Slave Species of God? What would you say about it? Is it a theory based on merely the Sumerian tablets or other things that you were able to discover and others have discovered? Is it more of an unproven theory where you took a few bits of evidence and came up with this? How would you categorize the book?
You know, I would say it's a compilation or it's an attempt at putting together a cohesive story of the human race since the beginning, taken from historic, ancient, prehistoric writings, from genetics, from science, from astronomy, from all kinds of literature that I could lay my hands on, and telling a story as cohesively and as simply as I possibly could to make it you know, palatable for the normal man on the street. I almost felt compelled to write this book because I found having read so much information and so much literature on the subject for so long that I often found when you get into discussion around a dinner table or around a coffee table with a bunch of people, and you start putting these theories down, you know, you get shouted down very quickly before you have any time to explain your theories or put any kind of substantiation on the table. So I thought, okay, the one way I can actually get my point across is to sit down and write a book about this, but write it in a way that people will be drawn towards it. So what I did, I took all this information and I tried to personalize it. So there's a lot of my own personal touch that I put into it. There's a lot of irony and sarcasm and hopefully humor that people will find in it as well. But at the same time, it deals with substantive information and knowledge. Some of it, as I said, is speculative because it is still unproven, and some of it is scientific. But then you got to ask yourself, you know, how solid is science? You know, we were told that there were 9 planets in our solar system. Now suddenly that is no longer so.
That's true. They're changing it. How did you get the title Slave Species of God?
Well, it became evident to me that if we look at how the human race has been manipulated through the various religious movements in the world, and how each one claims to have the higher ground and that they have the answer to everything, that we've become slaves to some form or some force that we are unaware of. And as Zachariah Sitchin has shown in much of his research and his own books, that we were created, it seems to be that we were created some 200,000 years ago, you know. And who is it that created us? If it was God, then who was this God that created us? And that's one of the other things that I deal with is the difference between God with a small g and God with a big G. And that's really, when you look at the title of the book, Slave Species of God, you'll notice that God is spelled with a small g. Because I'd like to draw the attention to the readers that there is a substantial difference between the two. And that we should not confuse God with a big G, the creator of the universe and all things in it, if that's what you want to believe in, with a God with a small g, who I believe we have been erroneously or wrongly praying to for thousands of years. And that is, according to my investigation and many writers before me, the God that created the human race, and therefore became the human race became his or their slaves. And that's in a roundabout way to answer your question. We have become slaves to the gods that created us, and it's a phenomenal story that involves ancient mythology, or should I say recent mythology. I don't know if you've thought much about this, but you know, when did our historians suddenly decide that these ancient scriptures were mythological? For thousands of years they existed as history and part of people's lives, and then suddenly a couple hundred years ago, or not even that long ago, our historians decided, well, we don't understand this, we'll just call it mythology.
Well, I have long believed that the gods of Greek mythology, I have long believed that the various aspects of some religions on this planet have taken all this and they have misconstrued the events that occurred hundreds of thousands of years ago, and they have capsulized it into their own beliefs, and therefore a lot of people have been very confused with what probably happened and with what people worship and who people worship.
Absolutely. That's exactly what slave species of God deals with. It's the confused state of the human mind. You know, with all the technology that we have, we're landing probes on Mars. We're watching pictures live from Mars. You know, we're discovering new planets in our solar system. We accept so much technology and so much advancement in science that we take at face value and we're okay with it. But at the same time, we cannot with absolute certainty say who we are as the human race, as Homo sapiens, where do we come from, and when did we get onto this planet?
Have you found anybody offended by the work, by the book?
Well, strangely enough, you know, I've been getting emails from USA, your listeners, I take it, because you must have done some sort of a promo before this interview.
Absolutely.
So I've been swamped with emails from Americans, most of them are very supportive, some of them are very critical, you know, and that is interesting. Once you start getting involved in religious dogma, it becomes an interesting debate. One of the chapters I deal with in my book is the world's religions. And I took the 12 major religions and I break them down to their point of origin. And what's fascinating is that, you know, we've got to keep in mind that when these religions first started out at their point of origin, that one moment, at that instant moment that someone decided that they were going to take on a new cause, which then eventually became a global religion. The world was a different place. We can't even begin to imagine what the conditions were like on this planet. You know, and the oldest religion in the world, as you know, is, as some people might know, is Hinduism. You know, the Hindu and the Vedic religion, which goes back in an oral tradition to about 8,000 BC and has been passed down and eventually written down in over 1,000 Vedic poems and Vedic scripts. And the stories that come out of there are absolutely phenomenal. If you ever want to see proof or evidence of actual interaction between gods, ancient gods, or the creators of the human race and their subordinate slave species called man or humankind, it's in the Vedic scripts. Just you know, go on the internet, type in Vedic scripts, and you'll be amazed at what you find.
They were either great storytellers, or the events that occurred back thousands and thousands of years ago, as you illustrate and as the Vedics illustrate, were truly remarkable.
It is absolutely fascinating. I digressed a bit. What I was leading up to saying is that when you take all these major religions, and I look at 12 of them in my book, and at the point of creation of these religions, the one thing that they all have in common is that there was some interference by an ancient mythological god that caused the creation and the birth of that particular religion.
Sure.
Whether it's Hinduism, whether it's Buddhism, whether it's Shintoism, Taoism, whether it's Islam, whether it's Christianity, they were all influenced and affected by some mythological god. Now, isn't that interesting?
Well, and nowhere in your book do you say that there is not this divine creator, this divine god, as you just said. I mean, you do understand, and you point out clearly that there is a higher power. Now, what happened to us. We're going to get into that tonight. But you do believe in that supreme being, don't you?
Absolutely. I am most definitely a theist. I believe in a higher power. I believe that there is a creation. A creator, should I say, that is responsible for all this. I, however, personally have not been able to put my finger on it and give it a name, give that power or that source a name. And I feel a little nervous calling it God because, you know, the word, the term God has become a little dirty to me because of what's been happening with global religions. And I don't want to offend listeners by this. I want people to just listen and step away from it, take the emotion out of it, and actually look at it practically and look at all the religions in the world. Is it possible, if there is one God that is responsible for the human beings, why has he sent so many different messages to the different people, and why have these different people with their different religions been at odds and fighting and killing each other for ever since the dawn of man?
How many various religions still believe that we are the only life in the universe because that's the way it's supposed to be? Do they still all feel that way, or are they changing?
That's a good question. I haven't really looked at it from that angle. My guess would be that there will obviously be the old stalwarts that are holding on to the, you know, the good faith and believe that they're the only ones, they're the center of the universe, and that's the way God planned it. But if you open your eyes and you step away from it, as I say, and you start embracing all the religions, you realize that they have so many commonalities, and yet they all want to separate themselves from each other. What's interesting as well is that, you know, for example, some of the religions, this is what I find most interesting about the religions, okay? So at the point of origin of all these major global religions, there's the heavy involvement of mythological gods. Okay, and that you can find out if when you read my book and you deal with a chapter on world religions. But after that, we then get involvement of these mythological gods, and then suddenly there comes a point in time when mythology stops and religion begins.
Now, Go ahead. Mike. I know we've got this little satellite lag here with you being in South Africa, but you're coming through loud and clear. We're going to be taking a break very shortly, and then we'll come right back to you. You're with us for 3 hours tonight. And when I do, I want to talk when we come back, Michael, if you could just give us an illustration of what you think happened 200,000 years ago on this planet, what this planet looked like, what kind of species might have been on the planet, and the events that unfolded. And one of the things we'll be doing with our guest tonight, Michael Tellinger, as well, is backing up some of the things that he says with some of the facts and documentation that he's been able to uncover ever since he's been doing his work. His website is called slavespecies.com. All of that is linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so you can get right to his website. Like he said, we have put this on our website for the last couple days, so a lot of you are already emailing him. But this is a fascinating story, and it really does pick up where Zechariah Sitchin left off. So we'll be back in a moment with our special guest, Michael Tellinger, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Michael Tellinger. He is live in South Africa. His book is called Slave Species of God with a small g. Michael, let's go back 200,000 years ago. Kind of explain for us, paint us a picture of what the planet looks like, what species are there, and what's starting to happen.
Okay, I think before we get there, I'd like to first pave the way by saying that the oldest known written information that we have at the moment are the Sumerian tablets. Many of your listeners might be aware of it, some might not. And what's fascinating is that as you mentioned earlier, Zechariah Sitchin will probably always hold the high ground in doing a lot of the work in that area. But there have been others. And what is wonderful is that because of the other translations, we have corroboration, we have evidence that shows that his translations are not nonsensical, that they actually hold water, and that there is a lot of truth in what has been written in the Sumerian tablets, that they corroborate each other. Now, what seems to be coming out from the Sumerian tablets, the information is that around 450,000 years ago, a group of astronauts from a distant planet in our solar system arrived on Earth in search of gold. Now, it all sounds very fantastical, but if we put it into context, we are doing that on Mars. We're looking for strange elements and signs of life on Mars. So, you know, let's not, you know, look at it, you know, too strangely and say, no, it's far-fetched, it can't be possible. So these astronauts arrived on Earth from another planet, and they settled on Earth in search of gold. They found gold. The reason they needed gold is because their planet was in dire straits. It was struggling with ozone depletion, and they were seriously under threat by various cosmic rays and so forth. They found the gold that they desperately needed to save their planet. They started mining the gold. After some 200,000 years on the planet, they decided that they didn't want to do this work anymore, and they decided to create a primitive species to do this hard labor for them. They looked around, and they found a species that was running around in the African bush, which we now believe is Homo erectus, and they took their own DNA, and they took the DNA of Homo erectus, and they combined the two to create Homo sapiens.
So the species at the time, prior to this genetic altering, they couldn't have used in the present form that it was in, right?
That's right. They tried to, according to the translations of the Sumerian tablets, they tried to use some of the Homo erectus, caged them, but they were just wild animals or behaved like wild animals. And they believed that they needed to create a species that could take instructions, that could speak, that could communicate with them, but not be smart enough to try and play sort of poker with the creator.
And so, they were basically looking for then a labor force, right?
That's exactly, you know, and that's exactly what they did. And the Sumerian tablets are very clear about this. You know, there is absolute clarity and great detail about what happened around 200,000 years ago, how they took the DNA and how they spliced the DNA, how they blended the DNA with or combined the DNA with that of the creature, and how many times they failed and how long it took to actually get the perfect formula to create this new species. And strangely enough, believe it or not, guess what they called it? The Sumerian tablets call it Adamu, where the Bible gets
yes.
The name Adam from. You're probably aware of this. And then it goes on from there. And what's interesting is, you know, the Bible tells us how Eve was created from the rib of Adam. Well, the Sumerian tablets, as I said, which are much older than the writings in the Bible, tell us exactly the same story. But here's the interesting scientific little hook that makes you realize that what the Sumerian tablets are writing, or what is written there, is really scientifically sound in so many ways. Because once they created the perfect species, Homo sapien, and they wanted to create a female version of that species, they didn't go back and, you know, try and recombine the DNA from themselves and Homo erectus.
Right.
They actually took the DNA of the male that they created, and they just cloned it to create a female of that same species.
All right, hence the story about taking the rib from Adam, right?
Exactly. And the same story, as I said, is written very clearly in the Sumerian tablets. Zachariah Sitchin has translated it beautifully for us.
Okay, so they did this. They developed a workforce. They needed the gold, as Zechariah has pointed out, and you do too, Michael, to, I guess, sprinkle it in their atmosphere, almost to shield the planet somewhat.
That's right.
God knows how much gold they extracted from this planet.
Well, you know, that is fascinating, and I'm glad you stumbled upon this thing, gold, because according to what I've found, is that there are two subjects that are the two common denominators in our human history that we can trace all the way back to the origins of humankind are gold and slavery. Now, isn't that just too cozy for comfort?
Yeah, absolutely. You know? I mean, even to this day, this planet is obsessed with gold.
Yeah,
and
I was listening
and you
to
wonder
some
why.
Of the I was listening to some of the inserts during the break, you know, and it's interesting to listen to what comes on your station. The little promos that talk about truth, about control, about land and real estate, and about gold. And we're having the same debate now that they were having 200,000 years ago. You know, and let's look at the obsession with gold. It is absolutely fascinating that gold, which is a relatively, well, not relatively, which is very difficult to extract from ore, that gold became the obsession of early humans. And I find it very difficult to believe that some primitive hunter-gatherer was walking around and stubbed his toe on a rock, looked down at this piece of rock and said, wow, if I take this piece of rock and I crush it, I wash it with arsenic and cyanide, and I filter it through hydrochloric acid and then dilute it with nitric acid, I will have gold. And then I can mend it, I can blend it, I can melt it at 800 degrees Celsius, and I can create beautiful ornaments that I can hang around my neck. You know,
and maybe I can buy things with it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sorry. I just don't buy that. So where does this human obsession with gold come from? And the Sumerian tablets are filled with evidence that this is the main reason why the human race and Homo sapiens was created, to become cheap labor, slave species. That's why the book is called Slave Species of God, slave species to work in the gold mines. They also tell us that these gold mines were situated in Africa, predominantly in southern Africa, and isn't just too cozy for comfort that this is also where the cradle of humankind seems to be located.
Oh, and it also where this interview is originating from tonight with you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I find it, you know, writing this book was an interesting experience because it made me look very differently at my role and my position. Sitting here, as I said, 20 minutes from the cradle of humankind, which is, by the way, an incredible experience. If you ever come to South Africa, come to Johannesburg and come check this out, because the government has spent over 600 million rand on developing this as a tourist attraction. It is mind-blowing. You know, to sit here and be so close to the cradle of humankind, at the same time having grown up on the gold fields in South Africa with my father being a gold miner, and never, ever thinking about the two go hand in hand.
Well, and Michael, even though we're talking about hundreds of thousands of years ago, is there ever any physical proof there that there might have been ancient mining going on? And I mean really old mining going on.
No, very much so. Very, very much so. There's just, as I said, just right here, a 20-minute drive from my house. They are ancient gold mines that have been dated to 30,000, 50,000 years. And I'm not talking about alluvial mining where the gold sits in shiny nuggets on the edge of a river. You know,
this is deep down in the plant mining.
Exactly. Okay. You know, so you've got to start stepping back from this and saying, okay, who gave these ancient humans, the early humans 100,000 years ago or so, the knowledge to mine gold from ore? Surely they didn't come up with that on their own. Somebody must have given them that information. Somebody must have driven them to do this mining. And that brings us to another very interesting subject. You know, the biblical stories of King Solomon and these gold mines in Africa. And there is more and more emerging evidence that these gold mines were in southern Africa, and that they were possibly in the lands of Anamatapa, which is in Zimbabwe, Monomotapa in Zimbabwe, where also we happen to have one of the most inexplicable ancient ruins, which is the Great Zimbabwe Ruins. Now, the Great Zimbabwe Ruins.
Is there ever any evidence there of ancient machinery that might have been used to drill out this gold, this ore?
You know, the evidence of machinery is a tough one. The Sumerian tablets do talk about machines that were created and brought to use. However, evidence of those in physical form, I don't think anyone has I certainly haven't read about any of that, except there are ancient depictions of miners using some sort of machinery, having some sort of source of light to be able to see in the dark passages underground, and so forth. What is fascinating is that the Sumerian tablets tell us about the god Enki, who was actually the first original astronaut that settled on Earth in search of gold. He apparently made his home in the in the Abzu, which is southern Africa, and it says, near the gushing waters of the river. Now, there's only one river in southern Africa that has gushing waters, and that's the Zambezi River. And it just so happens that the ancient ruins of Great Zimbabwe are close to the Zambezi River. And there's a, there are two very distinct ancient civilizations that seem to have emerged in that area. The first and the most original one is the Great Zimbabwe ruins, which I believe, and many others, that that was probably the stronghold of Enki, the first astronaut on Earth, and the miner the, who headed up the mining operations in southern Africa. That's where he set up his base.
What do those ruins look like, Michael?
Oh, it's a phenomenal – it's a whole precinct with stone structures that are probably about, you know, 4 or 5 meters high, maybe taller in some places. There's like a main center that must have been for the ruling god or ruling personality, surrounded by smaller structures that look like they were some sort of compounds for people to stay in. And the interesting thing is that the way the Zimbabwe ruins have been built are using very similar technology to what was used in the Great Pyramids of Giza. You know, no mortar, no cement, just stone perfectly packed on top of each other that has lasted for thousands and thousands of years. So there's some very interesting archaeological structural similarities between the two. The Egyptian pyramids of Giza and
how many came and how long did they last?
Are you talking about the original astronauts that settled
yes.
on Earth?
Yes.
Well, originally it was a small number of people. If my memory serves me right, I think it was about 50 or so that arrived, and they started setting up the bases. Now, what's interesting is that. They seem to have splashed down in the Mesopotamian area, which is between the rivers Tigris and Euphrates, or in that area where Iraq is today, where I'm sure Americans will be very familiar with Iraq at the moment. That was the original settlement of these early astronauts. They seem to have exhausted the gold supplies in that area quite quickly because they were mostly alluvial gold, and it seems from the Sumerian tablets that they also extracted gold from the sea, like we still do today extract diamonds from the ocean beds. And then after that, they needed to find larger deposits of gold, and that's when they moved down into southern Africa and started getting involved in the more difficult source of kind of mining, and that's all gold ore mining. You know, just to come back to the Zimbabwe ruins thing, what I find fascinating there is that there's this very ancient evidence of civilization when mankind was first created, you know, possibly some 200,000 years ago, and started digging for gold in this part of the world. And then there are much older ruins, and there are many of them. I believe there have been as many as 500 that have been excavated in the Zimbabwe area, close and around the Great Zimbabwe ruins, which are much later in structure and style. And that resembles very closely the Phoenician architecture and the Phoenician style of mythology and god worship, with temples and worship places that are virtually identical to the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians are well known for having traveled down the coast of East Africa into what I believe was at that stage Monomotapa, which was the land of Ophir, which is the land of gold, where King Solomon got all his wealth and his gold from.
You know, I always thought that the higher the technology, the more sophisticated the living environment. And then I think back, Michael, of the Star Wars movies where they had this incredible technology, but all the homes and the huts and the places that they lived in were out of stone, and there really wasn't anything too elaborate about it. So I would guess some of the ruins that you're talking about now might have fit that category.
Absolutely. You know, I think the pyramids of Giza are a great example of how buildings made out of stone can withstand thousands and thousands of years.
Absolutely. So they, I guess, once they got the amount of gold that they needed, did they just simply leave If I recall, Zechariah Sitchin, wasn't there some kind of war going on between the factions of those ancient astronauts?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where the wars on Earth began. You know, once they started... What happened here is they realized that they were going to have to stay longer than they originally anticipated. And obviously they didn't like that because they wanted to go home. And they also were getting tired of doing all the hard labor, which resulted in them, you know, as Sitchin calls them, Anunnaki, and they've become known as the Anunnaki, the original settlers, astronauts on Earth, originating from their supreme commander who was called Anu. Once they settled on Earth and they realized they had to stay longer, they didn't want to do all the hard labor themselves. They created this slave species that was going to do all the work for them. They manipulated the DNA so they weren't too smart. And then time carried on ticking by, and the gold that they were producing was just not enough. You know, their planet seems to have needed more gold than they originally anticipated. So they stayed and stayed, and with the longer they stayed, the more trouble started brewing. I mean, if we take this at face value, we are the genetic offspring of these early astronauts that settled here. So and we must have... Yeah?
No, finish.
Yeah, we must have a lot of their DNA, a lot of their personality and characteristics that run in our blood and run through our bodies. We often... we must behave in a similar way. And it is... to me, it is clearly evident that if you read the Sumerian tablets and start reading about the arguments and the battles and the fights that started to break out between these early Anunnaki settlers, the humans are behaving very much the same way today.
And did they breed with Earthlings or the genetic offspring of the Earthlings?
Well, I think you're leading me to a very important part of this debate, often very sticky question.
Well, we will get to that. Let's get to that when we come right back after the top of the hour, Michael. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, let's talk a little bit if we can, because you are right. We are going to move into some controversial territory here. But it is strange to me that the story of the Anunnaki and the fact that they came down to this planet and then they started to genetically alter what was on this planet, and then we became the humans we are now. The biblical stories talk about fallen angels breeding with the daughters of man. I've got to ask you if you believe that's the story here that we're beginning to uncover with this species, this race that came down to our planet. I mean, they came down. It could be construed that they were fallen angels. Is this one and the same?
You know, fallen angels is an interesting tag or name for them. I have my own theory on the angels, which I'd like to get to a bit later. But just to dive right into the deep end, and by George, you are opening a can of worms now, you know.
Yes,
that.
We are. Okay. Here we go.
Genesis 6, verse 1 to 4, says, "When men began to increase on earth and daughters were born to them, the divine beings saw how beautiful the daughters of men were and took wives from among those that pleased them. The Lord said, 'My breath shall not abide in man forever, since he too is flesh. Let the days allowed him to be 120 years.' It was then and later too that the Nephilim appeared on earth, when the divine beings cohabited with the daughters of men who bore them offspring. They were the heroes of old, men of renown." Now, you know, those are some very hard-to-swallow words that come straight out of Genesis, the Old Testament. Now, what's fascinating is that the exact same story is written in greater detail in the Sumerian tablets. Now, for those that haven't studied the Sumerian tablets, once you actually delve into it and you start looking at the volume of work there that is captured for future generations like us, it becomes absolutely evident that most of the stuff written in the Old Testament has been taken out of the Sumerian tablets and edited and put into some different kind of context for the generation of that particular time. And I have no doubt in my mind that the settlers on Earth, the Anunnaki, as we call them, gods, our creators, the creators of this new species called Homo sapiens, that they did start having sex and interbred with the species that they created. You know, after all, the human race was a beautiful race 200,000 years ago already. The women were gorgeous, as they are today. If you were a young son of a superior being that was on Earth, and you saw a gorgeous, you know, girl by the river, wouldn't you get excited about that?
Yeah, I guess I would.
Exactly. And that's when the trouble began. Now suddenly you had offspring that were half gods and half mortal or half human, and various arguments began to erupt. And that's where the interesting Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the most studied ancient historical documents, the Epic of Gilgamesh, who believed Gilgamesh, who was a king, who believed he was, who was half god and half human, who wanted to be bestowed the same privileges of the, as the gods. And he went in search of immortality. Unfortunately, the story didn't end very well for him, but it's a beautifully well-documented ancient historic document that talks about these half-bred humans.
Well, and they also talk about making man, going back just a little bit, in his own image, which is what they did, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Very clearly, Sumerian tablets talk about how they attempted, as I mentioned earlier, how they attempted to create this new species, and when they eventually got it right, and the new offspring, the new species, looked the way they wanted it to look, he made a sound like a human, which meant he could talk, and they, you know, the translations say that how Enki held the child up, saying, "I have done it. I have created him in my own image." Yeah.
If the story, Michael, is correct, then I've got to ask you about the story of Lucifer. Who in the heck was he when we talk about fallen angels maybe being misconstrued for these ancient astronauts? Who was this person?
Okay, I would take Lucifer as being the devil. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
He may have been an ancient astronaut, right?
Absolutely. Now, this is a really interesting story, and I love this part of the research, and Zechariah Sitchin has written about it, and I've delved a little bit deeper into it. And what is really fascinating, I mean, you know, the ancient symbol of medicine are the two entwined snakes that form, that sort of wrap around each other.
Yeah.
That has been the symbol of medicine for as long as man can remember. Now, incidentally, that is also the symbol for Enki or his son Ningirsida, who were, according to the tablets, the creators of the human race, of Homo sapien, who actually did the genetic engineering and spliced the DNA together to create the new species. Their symbols were the entwined serpent. For the symbolism, I'm not sure why that symbolism arose. My feeling is that one of the first, or if not the first creature that these astronauts, which was Enki, encountered on Earth, when he arrived on this planet, was a serpent. And that was obviously an image that was forever imprinted in his mind.
I see.
And he must have referred to it on many occasions, and that became his symbol on this planet. Now, being the creator of mankind with that symbol of the serpent, an interesting thing happened, that once they managed to create the human race, or Adam, and they put Adam into the Garden of Eden with Eve, which happened sometime later. Should I say, she was created sometime later, as we discussed, out of Adam's rib or Adam's DNA. And they put them into this garden to really observe these two new species, these creatures. They wanted to see how they got on, how they procreated, and would they procreate? And what the fascinating thing is that they couldn't procreate. They observed them and they just couldn't procreate. At which point they took them back and they introduced an extra chromosome into their DNA structure, which was the sex chromosome. Because one of the things they didn't do in the first place, when they cloned this female species, they didn't give her a sex chromosome. And that is fascinating. Again, you know, how could these ancient Sumerian tablets have so much detail and know so much about genetics?
Well, and you know what? That was genetics of hundreds of thousands of years ago. We're just starting to get that kind of genetics today.
Yeah, I mean, you in the United States, you have a number of pet cloning firms that have already opened their doors. You know, if your dog dies, they clone you a new one. Now, because we can clone species, and I bet you somewhere in some laboratory somewhere they're cloning humans, we're just not aware of it. Does that make us God? I don't think so.
It shouldn't, but it all depends on through whose eyes they may be looking at us.
Exactly. I think to the species and to the creature, you will be their God. Now, that's exactly what happened to us humans on this Earth. We were created by this advanced race of astronauts that arrived here for very dubious reasons. I would highly question their moral ethics and their laws of human rights that they had in their days when they created this new human race. You know, we can do it today. My question that I pose in the book is, what happens to us on Mars? Let's say, 20 years from now, when we've actually got a small colony on Mars and they need to expand the organization and the activity on Mars, what are we going to do? Are we going to wait 3 years every time we can send them like a shipload of more people to Mars? Or are we going to allow them to clone humans on Mars with specific DNA so that they can grow quicker, mature quicker, and then perform the functions that they need?
Good point. Good point indeed. And all of this, of course, brings me to this question. How did the Sumerians know this on events that had occurred thousands and thousands of years before this? And I would assume these ancient astronauts were long since gone. How did the Sumerians carry the story? How did they put it on their tablets? What happened?
Well, you know, the Sumerian civilization, as we know, it seems to be the oldest civilization that we know of as of now. And from them, we have basically attained most of the knowledge that we have in our so-called civilized world today. But, you know, they didn't have paper. They didn't have computers as we have computers today. They had different lifestyle. It was a different world, different place. Instead of writing with a pen and paper, with pen on paper, they wrote with a chisel and hammer or sticks on soft clay tablets, which were then hardened and kept for posterity. And there were all kinds of scribes. The Sumerians had scribes coming out of their ears. You know, they had scribes around every corner. School scribes, court scribes, scribes that captured wedding ceremonies or espousal ceremonies and so forth. And then you had royal scribes. As the higher you climbed up the ladder, the more important a scribe you were. And everything that they knew was captured in clay tablets. And the Sumerian tablets refer constantly to a time before time from where they get their information, from when the gods ruled and the gods decreed and bestowed all kinds of things to man and gave man knowledge of agriculture and civilization and domestication of animal and planting crops and all these things. So the Sumerian tablets seem to have had, or the authors of the Sumerian tablets seem to have had their knowledge from much earlier sources. The Sumerian king list is probably, it's a large clay tablet, sort of square-shaped. And it's probably, in my opinion, the most important historic document that we have. You know, it cites about 142 names of kings that can be traced back to, 220,000 years.
Oh, my. Well, what do you think the gap is, Michael, from the beginning of those tablets to when the Anunnaki left this planet, if they ever did leave? I mean, do you think they left, or might they still be here, or their offspring?
Oh, that's a great question. I love that one. It's what I'm asked all the time. I have no idea. My guess is that there's still some descendants of the Anunnaki here. And, there are some great authors that delve into the area of conspiracy theories and support their books with a lot of evidence and so forth. David Icke is probably the most famous one of them all. And, his research is superb, and it's hard to argue against. You got to be a real cynic and really angry with everything around you to want to fight that. But what's interesting is that I truly believe that where there's a conspiracy, there's like smoke, and where there's smoke, there must be a potential fire. And if we look at the control of global events today, I wouldn't be surprised if some remaining Anunnaki were still on Earth and pulling the purse strings.
Or at least their genetic line, huh?
Exactly, the genetic offspring. That's how I would see it. You know, let's think of it this way. How much do we know about the decisions that get made in the boardrooms of the giant corporations of the world? Microsoft, IBM, the companies that influence our daily lives in ways that we can't even comprehend. What do we know about what goes on behind those closed doors and how they plan their next month's activities and how they're going to control the world with their technology? We know nothing about that, and we never will.
Genetically, would Anunnaki direct offspring, would they be different than the genetic offspring that was created thousands of years ago? So let's assume that this planet evolved into two different directions. One was the genetic human beings that they made, and then, we went off and became who we are. And then there was the Anunnaki bloodline. If we were to take DNA of them and compare it to DNA of other people on this planet, would it be different?
My guess is they would probably be very similar, mostly because if we look at our DNA, our DNA is an interesting molecule. Our DNA, we only use about 3%, if that much, 3% of our DNA. The rest is what geneticists call junk DNA. So 97% of our DNA is absolutely useless. It has no impact or effect on us at all. Only 3% of the DNA has what we call exons that are active genes that are coded for something that controls you, your physical being. And so what is that 97% of the DNA for? My feeling is that much of that DNA is probably the remaining DNA of the original Anunnaki DNA that was switched off or disabled somehow to create this lesser intelligent primitive sort of working species or slave species of the early gods.
Good point. Yeah. Well, if they've got their other 97% working at full capacity, they must be very sophisticated compared to us.
Yeah, look, that's an interesting debate as well, because now you start comparing or getting into the debate of nurture versus nature and evolution versus creation. Because, remember, they also come from some planet somewhere, and at some point they must have also evolved or been created by a similar set of circumstances that we were created.
That's true, and eventually, if you do believe in that divine creator, that everything has got to lead back to that godlike figure eventually.
Absolutely. And the Anunnaki talk about that very specifically. In the Sumerian tablets, they refer to the creator of all and how they start getting deliberating about the moral issues about creating humans or creating a new species on this planet Earth. They debate that extensively, debating the moral issues behind it, whether they should create a new species or shouldn't. And that's fascinating. It's all fascinating stuff that leads back to God with a small g as opposed to God with a big G.
Well, this planet that Zechariah Sitchin talked about was called Nibiru, and it comes around every 3,600 years on a very long elliptical orbit. Do you believe that planet is still in existence? And if so, do you have any idea when it's going to get close again?
That's probably the second most popular question that people email me. I think we're all dying to find another planet in our solar system with some sort of intelligent beings on it that we can communicate with. I mean, Nibiru has become famous made by Zechariah Sitchin, and much of the most latest astronomical findings and discovery is corroborating his theories from 25 years ago on a daily basis. You know, if I said to you just over a year ago that, you know, there are more than 9 planets in our solar system, you would have laughed at me. Suddenly,
yeah, I probably would have, except I've got this inquisitive mind because I believe there's more than they've even found.
Yeah, exactly. Now, suddenly, a year ago, you know, our astronomers and our scientists make the startling discovery that, look at this, we've suddenly discovered evidence that there are many more planets in our solar system, not just the 9 that we are aware of. And isn't that just fascinating? But, you know, the Sumerians were writing about these planets a long time ago. They have been translated by people like Sitchin and others, and for many years being laughed at and ridiculed. But now suddenly modern science comes along and corroborates that evidence from thousands of years ago on these clay tablets. And, okay, well, now since our new scientists have corroborated this, we'll believe it. Now, why can't we believe at face value that what is written in the Sumerian tablets has a large element of truth in it and start behaving accordingly, or start using that evidence to look for new clues about our origins and about what's happening around our cosmos?
I agree, Michael. Even if 10% of what the Sumerian tablets say are correct and accurate, that's enough for us to investigate. Well, stay with us. We're going to come right back. We'll continue this discussion. And I also want to ask you about the possibility of a nuclear war that might have occurred here a long time ago, because archaeologists have discovered glass-like material which could only have been created by a nuclear explosion. I'm not going to say it was a bomb, but it could have been an asteroid or something else that created that. But let's get your take on that. And then at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines. It'll be your turn. I'll be back. Michael, archaeologists have found what could be remains, remnants of some kind of nuclear explosion that occurred a long, long time ago. They have found sheets of glass that could only have been formed by some kind of an explosion. I don't know what it was. Could have been an asteroid. Could have been anything. But doesn't Zechariah Sitchin talk about the fact that there were nuclear explosions, that there were wars between the Anunnaki, and that possibly this is what could have happened?
Absolutely. Zechariah Sitchin talks about him and about this as possible situation, but the Bible is very clear about the situation itself. It all depends, I suppose, how the readers of the Bible interpret it. And this is actually one of my most favorite parts of the Bible, because it's just so rich with visual imaginary that the story of Abraham and his nephew Lot and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is absolutely fascinating. One of the amazing things that I find is that, you know, the Old Testament is full of interaction between God and humans. Not just interaction in prayer, but physical interaction, where God comes down and sits down and has some food and wine and water with various humans, and normally accompanied by one or two angels, and then they discuss various things. And in this particular instance with Abraham, God came down and met Abraham accompanied by two angels, and they sat in his tent and they drank some, and they had some food and water and wine, if I'm not mistaken, and then God asked Abraham about, you know, this conspiracy against God by these evil, violent, evil people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And now, first of all, I find it fascinating that God would have to ask Abraham if there was a conspiracy against him,
yeah,
by the inhabitants of, yeah, by the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, surely God would know this. Secondly, the fact that God then instructed or asked Abraham to tell him that there is at least 1 or 50 righteous people there, and then he'll save Sodom and Gomorrah. And what you start reading in the subtext is that, you know, they had a plan of action here, God and these two angels. And by God, I mean God with a small g, which I believe to be one of the Anunnaki.
Sure.
and his two henchmen, with fierce weapons that are, you know, described in the Bible and also in great detail in the Sumerian tablets. Fierce weapons of destruction that could smite hundreds of people, if not more, at a time. And so what happens next is God says, okay, well, clearly you can't prove to me that there is one righteous person in Sodom and Gomorrah. This is the excuse that I was looking for. I'm going to send my angels in there, and I'm going to destroy these violent, evil people because they are conspiring against me. Now, what these people were conspiring and how they could possibly conspire against an almighty God is also beyond me. I don't quite understand that, you know.
What were they trying to do?
Yeah, what were they trying to do? My take on this is that I believe that those cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and there were more, by the way, in the whole valley that those two cities were in, those people might have been part of an early resistance movement to the gods, to Enlil and his henchmen, and Marduk, or whoever these Anunnaki gods and descendants were. They were causing havoc and a lot of hardship and frustration among humankind, and they started forming resistance pockets against the God of vengeance and brutality, which, you know, the Old Testament is full of evidence of. And God didn't like this, this resistance activity going on. He needed to take care of this. But because we're not talking about the God, the supreme being of the universe here, we're talking about an advanced deity with a small g. He needed a spy, a man on the inside. And that man came in the form of Lot, Abraham's nephew, who was planted very specifically to go and live in Sodom and feed back with information to Abraham about the activities and potential conspiracies against God. And this was a wonderful pivotal moment in the early days of the Bible. And remember that Abraham is the founding father of four of the sort of great religions of the world.
Right.
Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and also the Baha'i faith. They all look at Abraham as their founding father. So this is an interesting beginning that all of them should look at and analyze this as deeply as they can. So what happens next is God disappears back into the clouds, and the two angels go and lo and behold, who's waiting for them at the gates of Sodom? Lot is waiting for them.
There he is, exactly.
Yeah, there he is waiting for them. And he takes them to his house. He makes them as comfortable as possible. And before you could count to 10, the house is surrounded by a number of very angry people saying, "We know who you have in sight. We know those two guys have come here to do us harm. We want to bring them out so we can deal with them." And Lot starts to argue with them and say, "No, they're not here to do you harm. Take my 14-year-old daughter instead. Do with her what you want." I mean, these must have been very powerful gods to make a guy want to offer up his 14-year-old daughter. And then eventually they don't sort this problem out, and these two angels come out and they smite all these people around the house, and they basically kill them and make them blind and incapacitate them with these fierce weapons of destruction.
And could have been laser guns or something.
Well, exactly. You know, your guess is as good as mine, but they were certainly some form of advanced technological device that we might know of. I certainly don't, but, you know, the military people might know more about that than you and I. They certainly had the capacity to do that. Two guys just wiped out of, you know, maybe 500 people or how many might have gathered around the house. I don't know. And then they say, "Well, this is the evidence we needed. These are violent, disgusting people, and they conspire against God. We have to destroy them all." And they tell Lot to take his stuff, get all his family out of there, go across the plateau, hide behind the mountains, because they're now going to destroy the city and all the other cities with it, because they're filled with violent, evil people conspiring against God. And you know the story that followed. It's very well documented in the Bible how they destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and the descriptions are so graphic and so incredible that you could only really describe them today as nuclear explosions.
And, do we know where Sodom and Gomorrah is exactly today?
There are certain people that have made claims. I've put them on a map in my book, the latest research that I could find. Where there have been these various, as you said, fragments of glass and melted rock discovered that could have only been done by some astronomical explosion and incredible heat that could certainly come from a nuclear explosion or a comet or an asteroid. Now, we know that that part of the world was not hit in the past 200,000 years by a comet or an asteroid, so it must have been something else.
Is it possible, Michael, that our past civilizations, and I guess the evidence all points toward visitation, but is it possible this planet alone had an advanced civilization that blew itself up, and then we kind of started all over again. Is there any evidence that points to just that?
I must say I haven't delved into that part of the history in this book. I deal more with what we're discussing here, trying to paint a cohesive storyline of the last 200,000 years since the sudden appearance of Homo sapiens. So I try to steer clear of various other distractions, and I suppose what you're talking about is quite possible, because you know, there are other scientists and geologists that are talking about human race being on Earth, or some sort of a descendant or ancestor of human race living on Earth a million years ago already, and showing skeletal evidence of that, and et cetera. I haven't really delved into that, mostly focusing on our species for the past 200,000 years.
We know that humankind of thousands of years ago, some of them lived to very high yearly numbers, you know, Methuselah and others as well. Could it be that they were the Anunnaki and they had a very long life span?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about the DNA earlier, and how it all related to the Anunnaki, or the mythological gods, if some people want to call them
sure.
that. They certainly seem to have had a much longer lifespan, if not an eternal lifespan, based on what is written in the tablets. They looked at time completely differently to how we view time. And in that little passage I read to you from Genesis earlier, it also made it clear that God decided to make man's years 120 because he felt that he didn't want man to live longer than that. So again, it points to some sort of genetic manipulation, so that man, or the newly created Homo sapiens species, did not live as long as their maker, the Anunnaki gods. And I think the Sumerian tablets are filled with that kind of evidence. I'm just looking here at a Sumerian tablet that was discovered relatively recently, and again, corroborating a lot of what Zechariah Sitchin has been doing for years and being laughed at by many, corroborating all of his work. And this is, again, another thing that people must realize is that Sumerian tablets are being transcribed all the time. It's not something that has happened in the past and put away and there we have it.
There are some, though, who do not, you know, they have interpreted these tablets as being different than what Zechariah Sitchin has. So you are correct when you say there are some skeptics out there who don't accept his theories.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would invite those skeptics to do more reading, more scratching, more of their own research. You know, if you are skeptic, do your own research and just get on the internet. We have the luxury of having the internet, and you will find so much information it'll spin your head around for a long time to come. I mean, you know, as I said, you know, Sumerian tablets get transcribed all the time, so, and they end up in museums and in different shows around the world. One of the ones that I'm looking at here is a translation that this comes from the Schoen collection in Norway. It talks about these kings, you know, that rule for 28,000 years, for 43,000 years, for 36,000 years, and so forth, a total of 220,000 years. And they name them. They name the kings, they name where they ruled and who they were. Now, these are incredible things that are corroborated across various tablets. And definitely are in line with the genetic findings and the historical findings, the things that we've spoken about now, the events of Sodom and Gomorrah, that can only be explained if you start applying modern technology to it, and so forth.
Do we know, Michael, if the Anunnaki also paid a little visit to Mars? Is there any evidence that would suggest that?
Lots of evidence about that. I mean, we now know ourselves from our own personal explorations that Mars did have a living atmosphere. It did have water, what still has frozen water under the poles, but it actually had rivers and lakes. We can see the erosion patterns all over the planet. We can also see that Mars must have been struck by some huge catastrophe that stripped it of its atmosphere or caused the atmosphere to dissipate. So there's definitely, we now know from our own experience that Mars had a living, a possible living environment. And the Sumerian tablets talk extensively about Mars being visited by the Anunnaki. They, in essence, actually use it as a stopover on their way to Earth. We find that kind of thing preposterous. But, you know, I did a little calculation in my book to say, well, if we weren't, if we had the technology or the ability to take enough fuel or some sort of new energy into space with us, and we could accelerate a spaceship at, you know, normal kind of acceleration that most cars can accelerate at today at 10 kilometers per second per second, it'll take us exactly 4 days to reach Mars.
Exactly. But who's to say also that they didn't develop or find wormholes or abilities to bend space-time?
Yeah, you know, those are all things that our scientists and science fiction writers are talking about, you know, and Stephen Hawking is writing extensively about, and others, great scientists like him, are talking about wormholes and traveling through space in ways that we haven't, you know, thought of before. They might have done that, but even in just simple jet propulsion technology, you know, if you accelerate a rocket ship at 10 kilometers per second per second, within 4 or 5 days, you're going to start approaching the speed of light. And then you can get a long way, you know.
When you are at a gathering or a conference or a get-together and you talk about some of these theories, what do people say to you?
Well, you always have the skeptics.
Sure.
The know-it-alls, you know, the guys that just immediately tell you, oh, what a bunch of rubbish you're talking about now, you know, where you get all this rubbish from and that kind of stuff. They're just not prepared to listen, you know, and also people that just, you know, look at your book and they throw it in your face and say, I don't know where you got all this rubbish from. So, and then there are the others who have explored some of this, who might have read some Zachariah Sitchin and some other authors of books in a similar vein, and they love to engage in debate about this. And I find that I believe there's a growing global community of inquisitive people, open-minded people, even many people that are of a religious persuasion that are searching, that are maybe not happy anymore with the explanations that their particular religion is giving them. And they are searching for something new or something more substantial that can fill in some of the holes that they might have been struggling with in their knowledge of our human race on this planet and our road from many thousands or from creation to where we are today.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm stuck. I've got that feedback problem again with you. Go ahead.
No, so you know it's interesting when I do talk at functions and gatherings. It's predominantly if it's a planned gathering, then it's mostly people who are interested. If it's something that happens spontaneously as a debate around a table, then you normally get various arguments thrown in your face. And then I normally say, look, just go and read this book, and then we'll talk about it later.
You talked about the Vedics. How closely do they echo the Sumerian tablets?
Very closely, if you open your mind a little bit. As I said earlier, the Vedas, or Vedic scripts, are probably the greatest religious written work that shows no division between mythological gods and the activities of humans on Earth. And it's a lot of work. I mean, the Vedic scripts said they're over. I think there's 1,028 of these Vedic scripts or Vedic poems that exalt and talk about the ancient gods and their interaction with humans, how they smote humans, how they promoted humans, how they copulated with humans, how they punished humans, and also about the wars and the conflicts between these gods themselves. It's absolutely phenomenal that such valuable historical information has not been opened more to a larger global society, and I hope that discussions like this will lead to that.
Well, it's the flying machines, too, that fascinate me. Something was going on this planet a long time ago. There was high technology. There were planes. There were craft flying around.
Absolutely, and the Vedic scripts are full of that, are full of those references to flying vehicles, cars coming out of the sky, landing on Earth. It was the god Tvashtri, or Fashioner, who provided the gods with aerial cars and other mysterious weapons which appeared as handheld items in ancient Hindu depictions. And among those were a host of others. He created a trident for Rudra. He created fire weapons for Agni and the bolt of hurling thunder for Indra. And these are all involved and included in the Vedic scripts and phenomenal stories. There's a wonderful translation by R. Dutt, which contains the following. It says that the gods in cloud-borne chariots came to view the scene so fair. Bright celestial cars in concourse sailed upon the cloudless sky. Now, this comes from thousands of years ago. How do you describe this? Another interesting thing, George, is for example, the Akkadian civilization. The Akkadian had a word for flying vehicles, which was Tiarita. Now, why would they have a name or a word for flying vehicles in the vocabulary?
I know, it's amazing. Stay with us. We'll be back one final hour. It'll be your turn for phone calls now on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Michael, of the 12 religions that you looked at, are there similarities here that would match the Sumerian tablet stories?
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned, I found that at the point of origin of all these major religions, there was heavy interaction and involvement of mythological gods. And we've now established that the so-called mythological gods were actually real beings and deities that were part of the Anunnaki who came to Earth in search of gold, who created the slave species. And, I'm of the opinion that when the human race became a problem, they started planning some sort of an interventive plan of action. And they started to introduce concepts of divide and rule, and divide and conquer, by which they could control the slave species. And religion, or a form of religion, was a perfect tool to do that with.
Was the flood a mechanism to wipe us out, or was it some kind of, catalyst, earth changes, calamity from above?
It is historically documented now, and most scientists agree that around 13,000 years ago, there was a giant flood that swept the Earth shortly after the last ice age ended, and that the Sumerian tablets also tell us that coincided with the last orbit of the planet Nibiru, on which the Anunnaki dwell. And that particular time, the planet came very close to Earth, not only to Earth, but also to Mars, and causing great seismic and geophysical effects that the Earth hasn't experienced before. And it just so happens that the Earth was quite vulnerable because the ice age has just ended. And the Sumerian tablets describe in great detail how the polar caps of the South Pole cracked and slid into the ocean, causing waves possibly several hundred meters high, sweeping the planet. And we know from just a while ago how a small tsunami could cause such sheer devastation around the world. Now, and that was just a few meters high. Imagine a 200 or 300 or 400 meter high wave sweeping right across the world from the South Pole northwards. I mean, it would absolutely destroy everything. So the Sumerian tablets tell us about this, and they also tell us that the Anunnaki knew about this impending problem, and they wanted to use this to wipe out their mistaken experiment or slave species of the Homo sapiens, because it was becoming a problem to them. They actually didn't want to deal with this problem anymore. This is what my understanding tells me.
And,
go ahead.
Would you like to see Nibiru come by in your lifetime?
I would love to. Hopefully that would put an end to all the speculation and so forth. We were talking about that earlier, before one of the earlier breaks, and you asked whether, do I believe that Nibiru exists and its 3,600-year orbit and so forth. Of course I believe that. The Sumerian tablets tell us that in great detail, in not only in Zechariah Sitchin's transcriptions, but in various other translations as well. And we need to start looking at this seriously. Our memory span can hardly last 100 years or 200 years. We wonder what happened 200 years ago when they started discovering the last three planets in our solar system. 500 years, people are still burnt at the stake for making ridiculous remarks that the world was not the center of the universe. You know, we're a barbaric species. We're sort of entering our teenagehood of a species. We're behaving irrationally. And I would love to see a planet like this come by. I would love to see that put an end to all the speculations. And you know, if there are any cynics out there saying, well, how could it possibly be that there's a planet on this weird elliptical orbit around the sun? My answer to that is, well, we know that there are comets around on elliptical orbits around the sun, and many of them, many thousands of them. And some of them range from a few years to several hundred years to several thousand years in their orbits. Now, if we believe and understand that comets can have those weird orbits, why not some planets?
All right, let's go to the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. How are you today?
Good, thank you.
This is Ron. I'm calling just south of Chicago. I'm a trucker. I have a question for Michael. I believe in God with the big G as the almighty being, the almighty creator, and I also believe what you're saying about being created from beings. Do you have any thoughts on where about Jesus Christ would come into the picture, and if he is an Anunnaki or if he is actually the son of God with a capital G?
Oh, interesting question, Michael.
Thanks, Rod. I knew this was going to come up sooner or later. And it's a fascinating question. And I love this. I mean, I could spend 3 hours talking about this alone. Jesus Christ is obviously a very important figure in all our lives, in the global history, because from him came, you know, other religions and so forth. But there is growing evidence that Jesus was probably planned by the Anunnaki as some sort of a prophet to start changing the minds of the people. What I find fascinating is that if you look at the Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you look at their philosophies, the two philosophies are so vastly contradictory to each other that in my opinion, they should not form the same book. They should not be part of the same book. And in the entire Old Testament, you never hear a reference to Jesus or Christ or Savior or Messiah. The first time or Son of God, the first time you ever hear that word or any of those words or names is in the book of Matthew, which is the first book of the New Testament. While the Old Testament talks about a God of vengeance and retribution and punishment, which very closely fits the profile of the our creator gods, the Anunnaki, who mm-hmm. wanted to control humans. Suddenly they must have realized, hold on, maybe we're doing this the wrong way. Maybe we must send this sort of prophet that preaches peace and harmony and love between the people and a salvation on the other side of death. If you believe in us, in me, the God who created you, and there's a lot of evidence that was possibly the case. Now, I don't want to offend Christians by saying this, but, you know, Jesus Christ was a monumental historical figure. What he preached will probably be held in very close to people's hearts for many, many years to come. But at the same time, if you look at the origins or the circumstances around his birth and how it was planned, it makes one wonder. You know, that Mary, his mother, was also born of a virgin birth. Mary's father Joachim and his wife were not able to have children. And one day an angel appeared to Joachim and said, "Listen, you're going to have a daughter. Don't be alarmed. Just put her into this special school or monastery or whatever place they sent Mary to further north. And there she was prepared in this specific school that was run by a very secretive group of monks or a religious group of people that I believe were aligned to the Essenes. And then at a specific age, she was brought out of there and prepared to have this new virgin birth that produced Jesus Christ.
Well done. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello. How you doing, fellas?
Good, sir. Go ahead.
I have a couple questions, if I got a minute.
Yes, you do.
Scientists recently discovered through analyzing DNA that about 60,000 years ago there was a cataclysmic event that took place and wiped out most of humanity, leaving like a dozen to maybe 300 left. they tied it in with a supervolcanic eruption in Madagascar. I was wondering if the Sumerians had written anything about that.
To my knowledge, I have not come across any of that information. I certainly do not deal with that in this particular book. But you know, there have been many cataclysmic explosions. There's one just about an hour's drive from my house here north of Johannesburg. It's the Twying Crater that hit around, I think, 120,000 years ago. And that must have been right, you know, when the early humans were down here mining for gold. And that must have caused great havoc with the Anunnaki and their gold mining operations in southern Africa. It's a big crater. It's about just over a mile in diameter. And it's quite a spectacular sight to sit there and look at it. Yeah.
Okay, I have a more esoteric question. Let's say hypothetically that everything you're saying is absolutely factual truth, and that also reincarnation is factual truth. How would the two tie in? This is a totally hypothetical situation, but I mean...
Reincarnation is an interesting thing because reincarnation was heavily preached by the Egyptian gods, especially the god Ra and various other gods, and they wrote he dictated the Book of the Dead, and the Egyptians had to follow certain rules, and the pharaohs, who according to the Sumerian tablets were sort of half descendants of the gods, but they wanted to have eternal life, so. So Marduk, which was the son of Enki, promised them that he would give them eternal life if they believed in him. And he gave them various sets of instructions and rules to abide by. And that all, can be seen very clearly in the Book of the Dead. And their afterlife, what I understand, would have been on the planet Nibiru, where he would take them from here to another planet where they could live forever because they could manipulate the DNA and make them immortal like the Anunnaki are or were. And I see the afterlife as the religious scriptures. Remember that all the religions in the world are man-made. Okay, none of those have been written by God. They're all man-made, written by men who are fallible and need to be taken with a large pinch of salt. So you need to look at what it is that this afterlife actually promises. Reincarnation, the question needs to be asked, what is it that makes us human? Although we can create life and we can be gods unto ourselves when we clone pets or clone other humans, does it make us God? I don't think so. When we have created this life, where does the soul or the spirit of that new creature come from? That's a big question. And my theory on that is that we all are part of a much larger consciousness that fills the universe, and that we all belong to a larger spirit or a ethereal being that we are really small snippets and parts of. And once we die, our soul goes back into the greater God with a big G and becomes reunites with that. That is my personal feeling. There are many others that have various other versions of this.
Michael, assuming they genetically altered us and they held us back in intelligently for a bit with its DNA, how are we going to evolve now? I mean, we're at a point now where we're a pretty violent society, but at the same time, we're a pretty intelligent society doing the things that we've done, the space travel and everything else. Does it seem like if we were genetically altered, they did not make us as dumb as they thought they were going to, or maybe they came back and fixed us a little bit?
That's a great question, George. I believe that we have evolved beyond our maker's anticipation. And that is what was part of the problem. As we evolved as a species from some 250,000 years ago or so, and look, physically we look pretty much the same. I don't think we have really evolved on a physical level.
Right.
But and if we look at the DNA and genetic extractions from finds and so forth, skeletal finds and so forth, it looks like most of our evolution has happened on a spiritual level. And a scientific level where we have evolved mentally, philosophically, spiritually, And we're now coming to a point where we're asking these questions. I mean, if we weren't serious about this, we wouldn't be having a three-hour discussion about this. And I think the glowing population of the world is more interested in this. We are looking for the origins of our species. The answers we've been given are not good enough anymore. We want something more concrete. We need to know where we come from. I believe that if we don't know where we come from, it's impossible for us to know where we're going. It's just we're not going to solve the problems of our species. We're going to continue fighting until we know who we are and where we come from and why did we end up on this planet? How? What was the purpose for us that we ended up on this planet? Once we know that and we can agree on that, we can plot the route ahead and we can evolve. I believe that'll aid our evolution, it'll aid our growth in knowledge, it'll aid our planetary exploration, our cosmic exploration, and it'll make us a far more powerful and a united species to take on the final frontiers, as Star Trek calls it.
Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Lonnie from Mill Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of short questions and then a longer consideration. The first short question is, the author, what he thinks is the reason why they left? And a slightly longer question, not so long though, is where can we find the newer Sumerian documents? I've read Sitchin every book three times, and I've also gone to the library and read in some of the journals, but I'd like to know how to find the newer documents. And then the longer discussion is, my reading of Sitchin is that we were originally created purposefully to not be able to procreate. It's a little different than the way he was talking about it, that we were Lulus. They called us Lulus because the rule in the interplanetary rule is that you don't create a species that will procreate because that would interfere with the karma of the planet. You create a species that will die out. And that the later creation of our ability to procreate is a lot what the Garden of Eden is about. And so that's like a wider discussion.
Okay, want to hit on some of those, Michael, and we're probably going to run into a break, but I'll have you answer some of that when we come back, too. But go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Ronnie. Thanks very much. Why they left, I suppose my guess is as good as yours. I think they grew tired of the bickering, the problematic circumstances with this Homo sapien species. They possibly had enough gold because that's originally what they came for. But it's still possible, as George and I discussed earlier, that there still might be some descendants of them left behind on Earth. That's probably a subject and the topic for another debate. To answer your question about the new Sumerian tablets or other translations of Sumerian tablets, I suppose the easiest way to get it is just do a search. You know, do the good old Google search, and you'll be amazed at how much information you find. There is the Shoyan collection in Oslo has a lot of Sumerian tablets that are absolutely amazing to look at and to read, and some of them are as new as 3 or 5 years old that have been translated. And as I said, more and more are being translated. So if you just scratch a bit, you'll probably find them.
Is the translation new or the tablets they've just found?
Both.
Ah.
The tablets are new and the translations are new, according to my reading of it.
All right. And what about holding us back from procreating?
Holding us back from procreating, Ronnie is absolutely right. Sitchin has elaborated on that greatly, and the Sumerian tablets make it very clear. And that is why when the Lulu Amelu or the primitive worker was first created, he was created not to procreate. And that is what we discussed earlier, is that even the Sumerian tablets tell us how the Anunnaki had a moral debate and a moral issue about this creation of a new species. And then there was a time when Enki and Enlil, the two brothers that was the commanders of this new planet of theirs, had various arguments, and especially when Enki went and created introduced the sex chromosome to his new creation so they could procreate by themselves. You know, that seems to have angered a lot of the Anunnaki, especially Enlil, because now he had to deal with this growing problem of humans on this planet.
Stay with us, Michael. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up. We'll take final phone calls. Michael, anywhere in any of these writings, does it talk about Atlantis at all?
Well, Atlantis is obviously a subject matter that has been covered extensively by thousands of people, and it's possibly an interesting link between the movement of civilization from the original Sumerian Mesopotamian area through Europe and onto the island of Atlantis or the continent of Atlantis and then into the Americas. Because what is fascinating is that, you know, while these civilizations were emerging thousands of years ago in Mesopotamia, in the Indus Valley, and in Central America, they were all evolving at a similar pace, and they all had similar knowledge and information. And the one common various common denominators that they had was they were all there because of gold. They were all digging for gold, and they all had similar creator gods that they referred to as the flying serpent or the winged serpent. And in the further east you go, the serpent becomes the sort of a shape of a dragon and a winged dragon, and that gets taken up by the Eastern mythology and Eastern religions.
Have you ever seen the tablet from Abydos in Egypt that looks like a ship, a helicopter, and a flying machine? It's incredible.
Yes, I have. It's absolutely astounding. Absolutely astounding. I was looking at some of the stuff I've got towards the end of my book that might be fascinating for your American listeners. And it's by South African preeminent mystic and Sangoma or medicine man. He's a visionary. He's a highly respected author around the world. And I highly recommend his book, Indaba, My Children, to your listeners. But he talks about some interesting things in the ancient African tradition. For example, the Hutu people, the Watusi people, state that they're not the only people in Africa who state this, but they say that their very old ancestors were a race of beings whom they called the Emanuela, which means lords who have come. And some tribes in West Africa, such as the Bambara people, also say the same thing. They say that they came from the sky many, many generations ago, a race of highly advanced and fearsome creatures which looked like men, and they called them Zishwezi. And the word for Zishwezi means dival or glidal creatures that can glide from the sky or glide through water. And then also for the Oprah Winfrey fans, you know, she just recently came to South Africa to find her Zulu ancestry, and I believe she found it. Now, everybody should be familiar with the Zulu people of Southern Africa. Mm-hmm. And the name Zulu actually, also according to Credo Mutwa, means, its origin means people that can travel in interplanetary space between planets and in the blue sky and in the dark sky. And the Zulus claimed that many thousands of years ago arrived out of the sky a race of people who married their daughters and produced a powerful race of kings and tribal chiefs. Now, you know, if that doesn't blow your mind, then nothing will.
to the phones we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. This is Gabe from Walla Walla, Washington.
Hi. Gabe, go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. Hey, Michael. I just wanted to know if the Sumerian tablets talked about the devil at all.
Thanks, Gabe. The Sumerian tablets, not to my knowledge, they really talk about the ancient history. They don't delve into religion. The only time that in my research they talk about religion is when Enlil and Enki have this philosophical debate about whether they should create this new species of primitive workers, and when they discuss whether this would be okay in the eyes of the creator of all. So the devil was definitely a man-made figure, and again, it came from the conflict between Enki and Enlil after Adam has been created. Enki, as the creator, wanted the best for his creation. He wanted to inform them, enrich them, uplift them. He wanted to give them information and knowledge, and this all happened in the Garden of Eden, or Eden, as Sitchin and others put it. And Enlil was very unhappy with it. He didn't want this new creation to be intelligent and smart, and he wanted to stop their knowledge, and therefore told Adam and Eve that, you know, they're banished from the Garden of Eden and they must not have anything to do with the evil serpent. Remember that the snake and the serpent was the symbol of the creator of the human race, Enki.
Were the Anunnaki giants by any chance, Michael?
They obviously are many references to that. Anakim, meaning giants or large people, and it certainly seems from many of the translations that the Anakim the Anunnaki were giants. And in various biblical scriptures, I don't have it right in front of me now, but it talks about men being like locusts in front of Anakim and the Anakim. And so it certainly infers that the Anunnaki were larger than the species that they created.
Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hey, my name is Clarence, and I'm calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hello, Clarence. Go ahead.
And, you know, I kind of believe what your guest is talking about in the form of we never have a solution to what can create peace amongst man on the face of the earth. It's always a way to have wars and killing. And when he said religion can control a group of people, and that's true because all these religions was created by man, but yet none of them can ever come up to a solution where how do we stop man from destroying each other? No matter what pocket of the world you look at, there's always destruction amongst men, and nobody can come up with the solution to stop the destruction of man, but yet everybody claims that they have these religions that's supposed to be so good, but it's still you have the destruction of man is in every religion, not just one particular religion at all.
It's a violent society, Michael.
Clarence, what I'd like to add, thank you very much for that comment. What I'd like to add to that is, you know, if there's one thing I'd like the readers to take out of my book is that, and to start understanding the difference between God with a small g and God with a big G. In my opinion, we have been conned by these ancient advanced beings that created us. We've been conned into believing that they are God, and we have actually not been praying to the correct God. We've been praying to a God with a small g and being fearful and expecting retribution and violence and that kind of stuff. But the God with a big G, in my opinion, had very little to do with our existence and our creation and our being on this planet.
Wildcard Line, you're up on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, this is Alan calling from Las Vegas.
Hello, Alan.
And, you know, you beat me to the question of Atlantis, and the answer was that, no, it is not the same civilization as what I'm getting. So I guess I have to ask another question. Is everyone in the world, do we all come from the same alien intelligence, or do we come from different intelligence, you know, all the people, or are we from one alien intelligence? I hope you're following my question.
Well, that's an interesting question.
Alan, thanks for that question. You know, there's interesting, in some of the religions, the Sumerian tablets tell us about the seven primordial goddesses that gave birth to the first few primitive workers or slave workers. And then when you look at some of the other religions, like in Indian religion, there are the seven birth goddesses, which is, again, a very cozy set of circumstances, a coincidence that they also have seven birth goddesses or birth mothers that are at the foundation of the Hindu and the Indian religions. So my take on this, and from the angle that this book is written from, dealing with the Sumerian tablets as the oldest known information and written document of human history, from that point it looks like we were created by a specific group of advanced beings using their DNA and the DNA of Homo erectus. So I would say yes, we would probably come from one single DNA source.
Do you think these UFO reports that we get on this planet right now, Michael, are the Anunnaki trying to revisit us?
You know, it's difficult to try and come up with an intelligent answer for that, because I've tried in my book also try to stipulate a time and a point when the Anunnaki will come around again, you know, it's just so difficult to put a time point to that, because we can hardly see the objects at the end of our known solar system. You know, when we get to Pluto, things get, you know, quite murky for us. So even if the planet of Nibiru was at Pluto approaching us, we probably wouldn't really know much about it for quite some time before the astronomers pick up on it and start making a noise about it. So I don't know, you know, whether they're visiting us or not. I guess if they're nearby and they've cracked the problem of traveling close to the speed of light, they most certainly would be visiting us.
I assume their breathable atmosphere on Nibiru is pretty similar to that on Earth?
Yeah, they talk about that Earth was far brighter than their planet Nibiru, and also warmer. The atmosphere was problematic, as you know, we discussed this earlier, that the ozone layer was being depleted by all kinds of activities on their planet. But theirs was what they referred to in the tablets as a radiant planet. It had a very thick atmospheric cushion that protected it from the various rays, the cosmic rays, but also at the same time prevented heat loss and heat gain. Their atmosphere, I take it, the climate must have been a bit warmer than here. Sorry, a bit cooler than here, because it talks about the Enlil especially not liking the heat on Earth and moved into the higher, cooler areas of Mesopotamia.
You would think he would bring air conditioning with him.
You would absolutely with all their technology.
Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air. Hi there.
Yes. Good morning, George.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning to you and your guests.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. What do you believe the Anunnakis needed the guys down there in the Abzu for? You know, because you said it was there to mine gold. Now, what did they need the gold for?
The gold was sprinkled in their atmosphere, and you stop me if I'm wrong, Michael. The gold was sprinkled in the atmosphere because they need it. I guess they were losing their shield, basically. Is that true, Michael?
No, you hit it on the spot. Obviously, you know a lot about that. That's what the tablets tell us. Again, you know, they found that gold had the right ingredients and characteristics to use as a material to regenerate their depleting ozone layer. And they found that when they ground it to a very fine powder, they shot it into the atmosphere and spread it throughout the atmosphere. It created a protective shield to protect them from the dangerous cosmic rays. But you know, it's interesting because you know we look at this and think, it's a bunch of hogwash, you know. But when we look at us, ozone depletion is a huge ecological and environmental subject.
Sure.
on a day-to-day basis. And what are we going to do when we suddenly reach a point of no return and we realize that we've actually probably messed up our own ozone layer here? Are we going to reach for the Sumerian tablet and say, wow, listen, these guys did it with gold. Maybe we should do it with gold as well.
Right. Now, are you also on the understanding that the reason why the Adam and Eve were kicked out of the garden because they wasn't given they wasn't supposed to have been procreating, but the ones down in the Abzu, they were needed to procreate to do this constant mining?
From my understanding, it was Adam and Eve were put into the Garden of Eden really to be observed, to watch their behavioral patterns, to see how they get on, to see if they could procreate, and to see if they could get on. It wasn't about procreation. In fact, I think they wanted to have them procreate because they've gone beyond the procreation period already. But what happened is that their maker, or the entwined serpent, or Enki, that later became known as the devil, he wanted to give them information and knowledge about who they were, why they were on this planet, and what they were doing, so they could actually feel a sense of worth and sense of being. While Enlil, his brother, didn't want to have anything to do with this. He wanted to keep them ignorant. He wanted to keep them enslaved, and to a large extent succeeded, because after this, you know, they kicked them out of the Garden of Eden. They were told never to deal with the evil serpent, and from that point onwards, we start seeing the emergence of all the different global religions that are still keeping humans enslaved in fear.
Oh, okay, I see what you're saying. So you don't believe now that they were free from all of the toil and labor, and that they were like pretty much like basically the prototype, and
yeah,
they were free. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Like an experiment, weren't they?
They were an experiment. I mean, they were the prototype. You're quite right. That's how I see it. They were Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden were a prototype, and they were there to be observed so they could study them and see how they could possibly improve on them, or if they had any malfunctions or defects, I suppose, you know. I mean, what do we do with a new species? If we create a new species, we're busy doing that right now. You know, we're trying to reintroduce species that have been extinct for millions of years on this planet, and what are we going to do with them? When we do finally get this right and do it, we're going to keep them in an observation place and look at them to see how they adapt to their new environment. You know, we'll do exactly the same as the god of this new species.
Do they genetically alter us and grow us at real time, Michael, or did they somehow have a way to speed things up?
The tablets talk about that the Anunnaki females had a much longer gestation period than with their own offspring than when they were giving birth to the new humans, to the new species. So I don't think they speeded it up, not from my understanding of it and my research. But somehow the genetics got involved and the new blend of genetics speeded up the process.
Would it surprise you if this planet Nibiru came racing through our solar system at any time?
Not at all. No, I mean, as I said earlier, I wish that would happen. I would love to see that happen. You know, we've seen comets come and go. Now let's see a real planet come and go and give us something to really talk about and start reevaluating our place on this planet and who we are and where we come from.
Slave Species of God. Michael, where do you get the book?
My book is available, should be available in most bookstores in the United States, obviously on Amazon. Amazon.com, and if you're in the UK, it's also on Amazon.co.uk. The distributors are APG. If you go to apgbooks.com, you can go straight there. I think they have a special on the book. If you have any problems, just get onto my website, and I'll help you out.
I bet you had fun writing it and doing the research, huh?
I tell you, it was a journey of discovery. You know, when you start something like this, you have no idea the journey that you will be taken on.
And it's a journey that will never end, Michael.
It is fabulous. I must say it has changed my life. It has introduced me to people like yourself and others who are absolutely wonderful, who are passionate about this subject. And I believe that the 1.2 billion people on planet Earth that are without any religious convictions are a growing number of people that are looking for new answers and are hopefully going to help us find them.
Very good. Thank you, Michael. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDessour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.